Hello. As you may recall, in recent audio snippets, we've been talking about how things would be run in a new House of Commons under a new constitutional American system. And at some point, we began to talk about how the budgeting process would work in that new House of Commons. And then we got to the issue of how to legislate on taxation, because budgeting not only involves writing bills to decide how to spend money, there's also the need to raise the money that needs to be spent. And we began to talk about what kinds of valid legislation regarding taxation would exist under a new American constitution. And we began to say that basically we're just going to have a simple income tax with a flat rate of, let's say, 20% that would be applied on any income above subsistence level. And we just mentioned a number such as 36,000 just to have a reference point. And we declared that that would be the only form of taxation allowed, and that we would also theoretically allow for the possibility of a value-added tax that could be maybe incorporated in future. So it would be technically legal, but maybe not put into practice initially. And we, as we began to talk about that, we said that the Constitution needs to have a list of principles regarding what a metaphysically valid taxation should look like. So aside from just saying this is the only tax we're going to have, the Constitution needs to have a list of principles to that we must abide by, generic principles, and have the only form of taxation allowed to be an outgrowth of those principles. And the idea is that we don't want an amendment that or a clause in the Constitution that says simply the only form of taxation is taxation of income tax above a certain subsistence level, and it has to be a flat rate of such and such, and the only thing that can be legislated is the percentage, and that constitutionally there'll be a maximum of 20%, so no bill can ever be passed that tries to get more than 20% of people's income as tax. We could have a clause like that, but the problem is if all we have is that clause, is that eventually we can have a group of greedy politicians come together and try to convince people that we need a different form of taxation. And then they will come in and amend the Constitution through the amendment a process that would exist for the new Constitution. And then that clause would be removed, the original clause, and be replaced with another form of taxation. So it'd be a very straightforward a process of just changing a clause or adding a new clause that allows something else as a form of taxation. But if we have a constitution that not only has the clause on what is allowed as tax, but also has a list of generic metaphysical principles on what good taxation looks like, then if a new tax is someone tries to add a new tax to the constitution that violates one of those pillars, one of those generic principles, they will not only have to amend the Constitution to add the new clause, they will have to go in and officially abrogate one of the principles. So, for example, if they want to reinstate income tax on companies, because that we explained that income tax would only be for the income of individuals, not the income of companies, and we explain why it needs to be like that. But if let's say they want to bring it back, then they would have to abrogate or remove the generic clause that says any form of double taxation is illegitimate and unconstitutional, because if you're taxing income of the individual and you're taxing the income of companies, you are practicing double taxation. So when they go to the American people and say, we want to add this new tax back into the system because we need the money, then they'll have to admit to the American people, we want to double tax you. And we're going to have to take this clause out of the Constitution so that we can now start adding this new tax to you. So that is a double effort. So they'll have to be more frank and open about what they're doing. They'll have to be sincere with the American people and say, we really want to hurt you by adding a tax system that double taxes you, that taxes you twice. So that's why it's important that we have generic principles such as no double taxation, taxation that affects the economic process. In other words, the taxation has to be economically neutral. And another principle is no taxation on equity. And that would be unconstitutional and illegal. So we should have these generic principles as well as the actual clause that states what the actual taxation will look like. And that's what we've been trying to do. So we're going to continue talking about these things. And as we began to talk about taxation, we also, it became necessary to start talking about economic principles. And that's one thing that's very lacking in the American Constitution, the presence of things related to economic policy. And that's important, especially because of how things have degenerated in the American system with the intrusion of socialism and the intrusion of government programs that are sucking the life out of the economy and making us poorer as a nation. So the Constitution not only has to have political principles and a framework for political action, it also has to have a framework for economic activity, and it has to lay out economic principles so that when the people in the House of Commons are doing legislation that affects the economy, they will have things in the Constitution that will restrain them and prevent them doing things that are going to be harmful to the economy and to the nation. So that's very important. And as we began to talk about taxation in regard to not taxing companies, we're emphasizing that that's necessary because we need to have rich people in an economic system because wealth and productivity has been established once and again to be the outgrowth of economies of scale. So if you distribute wealth in an equal way and everybody just has one tiny slice of the pie, then it becomes difficult for people to do things and invest in things that will produce economies of scale. You need a large pooling of resources to achieve economies of scale, achieve efficiency that allows you to produce more resources with fewer input, with less input. And when you can produce more with less effort, you have more wealth in society, and that wealth will eventually just find itself distributed across the people. But if everyone is poor, they might be all equal, but they are equally poor. So that's why we do need to have rich people in society, because they can pull resources and establish infrastructure and do things that will create economies of scale. And if the only person or entity that can pull resources on a large scale is the government, then we are we're in trouble, because government, the people in government are not designed for efficiency, the efficient use of money. Because it's not their money, it's somebody else's money. And when you're handling somebody else's money, you are not as careful as when it's your own money that's at stake. And that's why it has to be in private hands, in the hands of individuals. That doesn't mean that we don't have to worry about the excessive consolidation of power when people have too many resources. So there have to be things in the Constitution also to fight against monopolies, and when people start using that accumulation of power for evil ends, like the bastards at Google, who have and other companies who have tried to use their big influence in the market to then crowd out the competition and then start imposing their political and social ideology, pushing that on people through the power of the resources that they have amassed. So now a company that like Google, that's supposed to be just a search engine company, has become a company invested in political activity and social ideology and things like that. And that's when we begin to have problems. So that has also has to be taken into account. But in general, and ironically, these people, the bastards who carry out all this oppression, when they accumulate a lot of power, like bastards like Bill Gates and like the Indian idiot at Google, who was running Google at the time of this recording, and all these people, all of them are leftists and Democrats. We're all about the little people and equality and all that. But while they're talking about all that from one side of their mouth, on the other, from the other side of their mouth, they are doing things and giving out orders and thinking out ideas that take advantage of their great power to do evil and impose themselves on others. So the thing is, now we need to talk a little bit in this snippet about the concept of rich people and the things that need to be in the Constitution to make sure that that principle of capitalism and people being allowed to have to accumulate property, that right to property, that's one of the five fundamental human rights, that can be protected. Going into that, I felt the need to mention a little bit about McCarthy, Joseph McCarthy. As many of you may know, he was a senator from Wyoming who rose to prominence in the early 50s, if I'm not mistaken. He was a senator from Wyoming, and he became well-known nationally because of his persecution of people that were supposedly communist or Soviet sympathizers. And he started declaring that there were a lot of communists infiltrated in the State Department, in the CIA, and the Army, and also in the film industry and all that. So he started this campaign to attack these people who he declared were trying to destabilize the government, the American government from within, with the help of Soviets. He eventually became discredited and all that, but his tactics were less than noble. But when you think about it, it's kind of odd that he kept talking about all the communists in Hollywood, and now, in 2020, you know, at the time of this recording, it feels like, wow, it sounds like he had a point, because of all the infiltration of communist and Maoist ideology and leftist thinking in Hollywood. So you would say, hey, he might have had a point in the midst of all the crazy things he said. And but the reason why I bring him up is that when he was bringing up this threat, that maybe he exaggerated, but it was in a sense there to be dealt with. His attitude was, let's attack the people who are trying to promote communist thinking in the country. And everybody who liked him started going in that direction. And the fact that he was so successful or so popular for a while is an indication of how we in America have always been trying to approach the problem the wrong way. We didn't at any moment stop and think, okay, it's more than just dealing with specific communist sympathizers. It has to be about our constitutional system. Does our constitutional system protect us from communism, from the capitalist system being dismantled from within? And no one really ever bothered to do that. And even to this day, we are not even thinking in that direction. It's always, we focus on the communist out there, the son of a bitch, bastard, senile, who's dragging his feet in the White House at the time of this recording. We focus on that bastard, hell-bound bastard, and say, oh, we have to get rid of that leftist communist thinker, and we'll be okay. Or we have to target this person or that person. But these people are the outgrowth of a system that's flawed from the beginning, because the Constitution is so weak and pathetic when it comes to economic issues that it has nothing really in it to defend capitalism, nothing to protect it, to provide an infrastructure that will make it difficult for politicians to come later and try to inject communism, communist thinking, socialist mindset into the legislative books. There's nothing there, and that's why we need to start adding, thinking about these things, and we need to be adding them to the new American Constitution as that document is written out in the years to come. And so we have to start analyzing, okay, the leftist thinking is always, oh, we need equality. We need everyone making the same amount. And if someone's making too much money, that's evil. There's something wrong there. And I find that ironic that these leftists think like that all the time, but they worship the Tesla fellow. And they worship Bill Gates. They worship the crazy worker exploitation king from Amazon. All these super, super, super rich people that are all leftists and promote leftism, but then they pretend like that's not a contradiction of their philosophy. Then they turn around and tell everybody else, but you all have to share the wealth. They don't have to, because they agree with us, but everybody else, you all have to share the wealth. And we have to start trying to think, okay, what happens, how can we counter this mindset that we need equality, the way the socialist thinks about it, for us to have a peaceful and prosperous society? So let's analyze, let's do a thought experiment. The way Einstein would do things, he would go into thought experiments. And I think that's a very important principle that we have to practice. We have to set up an experiment in our mind and see how it plays out. So let's say, for example, that we have a town, and the town is basically this big piece of arable land, fertile soil, and everybody says, okay, we're going to split it. Let's say it's like 50 people. And so they split it into 50 equal parts, and everyone gets their slice, equal slice, and they will, you know, cultivate and, you know, plant and do you know, agricultural stuff in their piece of land and produce their own food and everything. So okay, so everybody takes up their piece of land and they start sowing seeds and planting and watering and doing all that agricultural stuff. So let's say that one of the 50 begins to notice that everybody else is doing something wrong in the way they are, you know, sowing their seeds. I know very little about agriculture, so I can't give a real life example, but just let's say hypothetically that he notices that everybody else is sowing the seeds the wrong way. You know, I don't know exactly how, but they're doing something wrong. And because they're doing something wrong, then their crops are not that big, you know, that prosperous or abundant. So he starts telling everybody, hey, you need to change this. And he goes around to all other 49 pieces of land and talking to the owners, and but no one wants to listen to him. They all think he's super crazy. That's not the way to do it. Go away, leave us alone. So he comes back to his own piece of land and says, no, well, I know what I'm saying is true. So if they don't want to believe me, that's their problem. I'm going to do it the right way. So he starts doing the you know, correcting the mistake that he's seeing in others. And then he starts getting better crops. So he starts getting all this abundant harvest of fruits and vegetables and things like that. So now let's say that the socialist comes in and says, hey, you know, everyone has to have the same income. Everyone has to have the same result. So the question that we have to ask then is, would it be fair for that person who told everybody else they were wrong, no one listened, he went ahead, did it the right way, and because of that, he doubled his crop. Is he now obligated? Would it be fair for him to have to share his excess crop with all the other 49 people who would not believe what he was saying? Would you think he's fit? It would be fair? And let's add to that, let's assume that these people are so stubborn that they're not willing to admit that he got twice the crop because, you know, he did what they believe is not the right thing to do. And they are still going to continue doing it the wrong way. But they expect this guy who is doing it the right way to give, to distribute his excess crop to everybody else. And they, let's say that they attribute it to luck. Oh, he got a better piece of land, and that's why he's getting twice the crop. And his obligation is to share the wealth with everybody else. Would you think that's fair? And obviously the answer is no, because he is doing better because he's doing something that everybody else thinks is wrong. So in that thought experiment, we have equality, forcible equality being evidenced as something completely unfair and ridiculous. Let's give another example. Let's say that one of the people in that place is a very creative person, and let's say that he decides, hey, this soil is very good for this type of fruit that no one had thought of, but he thinks about it and he goes, wow, it would be wonderful, and he designs this ingenious way of irrigation or something to make this seed take hold in the soil and produce with great abundance. So he goes ahead and does it, and then he starts getting all this extra crop and harvest, and he has this wonderful new fruit that's delicious and everybody loves it. He had this wonderful creative idea. Now the question becomes, is he supposed to distribute this wonderful new fruit and harvest with all the other 49 people? Would it be fair? He was the one who came up with the idea. No one else did. Because he was thinking out of the box. He wasn't just repeating the same boring process over and over again. He said, no, let me try something new, something different. Let me try a different seed. And he was able to get it to work. Would it be fair that he will have to distribute that excess wealth with the other 49? And obviously the answer is no, because at that, what was the point of him having a great idea and being willing to take a risk? Because he was taking a risk when he did this. If he would have failed, he would have gotten less crop, but he said, I'm going to go ahead and try this. And he was able to successfully produce it, and now he's supposed to distribute this with everyone else when everybody else was just being traditional. That would clearly be unfair. And also, if it doesn't matter whether you have a great idea or a lousy idea, if you're going to get, if you have the safety net that everybody gets the same amount of harvest, then if I have a crappy idea, a terrible idea, I carry it out, it's a big failure, I know I'm covered, because the rest of the other 49 landowners are going to have to pitch in to make my net harvest equal to theirs. So what's the point of worrying whether I will, you know, fail or not. So clearly in that example, again, we see bad equality is a terrible idea. Another example that someone who is very very pastoral, he loves animals, and he decides to bring in sheep or some other animal. So he starts turning this place that was just for vegetables into a farm, a full-blown farm with animals and everything like that. And he starts getting sheep and pigs or whatever. And because he had this tendency towards pastoral care, he loved animals, so he started producing this. Now, is he supposed to share the sheep and the pigs with everybody else? Obviously, that wouldn't be fair. Let's say a simple example, fourth experiment, where someone is just a very hard worker. So he gets up early in the morning and works the land and goes to sleep late at night. And because he's working so hard, he produces more than everybody else. Would it be fair for him to then have to give that away? What I'm trying to point out is there was no injustice happening. It's just people being themselves and sometimes producing more than the people right next to them. Not because they were oppressing. It was not that the guy who had the ingenious idea to produce this new seed was not oppressing the other 49 guys to become richer. He became richer out of his own creativity. And that's one of the underlying principles in socialism, is that equality is necessary because inequality is always the outgrowth of injustice. And so because somebody, you know, it has the resources, and is greedy, and is stealing from everybody else. But no, we are seeing in this thought experiment that inequality, someone having more than others, doesn't necessarily come from injustice. It's just people being different. The guy who has more sheep and pigs than everybody else, it has them because he loves animals. He's a pastoral person. He loves to shepherd animals. So that's how he ended up with animals, and the other guys didn't. The guy who was saying what was right, what was wrong, and said, no, this is the right way to do it, and he had this kernel of wisdom that no one believed, and then he went ahead and applied his kernel of wisdom and produced more. Is he having more because he's being unfair? No, he was trying to share the idea with others, and no one believed him. So he went ahead, did it his way, and he was successful. Why is he going to be punished? And let's say a fifth example of someone who is very, very entrepreneurial, and he has these ideas that I'm gonna set up this cafe or a coffee shop on one of the corners of my property, and I'm going to start a business, and I'm going to invite the other 49 to come along, and I'm going to invest in this business. I'm going to sow coffee seeds and produce coffee, and I'm going to serve coffee to these people, and maybe I'm going to hire one of the sons of one of the neighbors to be the barista serving the coffee and all this. He's a very entrepreneurial person, and he's taking risks, and he wants to become the coffee supplier of the entire area. And so he's going to become successful because he's offering this new service that everybody enjoys. So was he oppressing anyone when he came across this idea and became very successful because he's entrepreneurial? No, it's just him being him. So it would be unfair that now we're going to punish his entrepreneurship by having him distribute his wealth, his profits, to everybody else, to all the people who never took a risk in their lives and who weren't willing, interested in trying new things and conquering new markets or new territories. So you can see these five examples that basically people being themselves will produce inequalities. I will produce some things that others don't produce because I'm just being me. It's not that I'm oppressing anybody else. It's just that I have certain qualities other people don't have. So inequality will arise without a need for injustice. And that's because we have different personalities. And when it comes to equality, it's interesting that the focus is always on money. But the problem is, money is a very, very narrow-minded way of assessing happiness or prosperity. And by that I mean, or justice, because basically we have. The human being is made up of seven parts or seven the spectrum of the human personality or the human nature covers seven colors like the rainbow, and one of them is the judge, people who are always saying what is right, what is wrong, like the fellow in the example that we were mentioning. There's the visionary, that's the second quality or second part of our human spectrum, the people who have visions about new ideas and are willing to make sacrifices for these new ideas. There's also the conqueror, the first, the entrepreneur, the one who goes out and tries new things and conquers new territories. There's also the server, the pastoral person who likes to serve and tend to things and tend to animals and things like that, like the person in the example. There's also the organizer, the hard worker who organizes things and is a perfectionist. And so different people have different personalities. And there's also the dreamer, the person who dreams of great things even while he's small. And there's also the prosperer, or what I would call the peace bringer or peacemaker. But when I say peacemaker, I don't mean it in the traditional sense of someone who's there at the bargaining table trying to get two people to compromise to reach peace. That's not what I mean. But there are certain people who have this quality that everything that they get into prospers, and they bring peace to a place. So those are the seven sides of human nature, and some people are born with one thing more ingrained than others. And the idea is to eventually all of us being adept at all seven things. But we are our factory settings come with certain things more developed than others by default. And when it comes to money, the part of the spectrum that's most directly associated to monetary success, I would dare say, is the conqueror element. So that means that the people who are entrepreneurs, if you take it from the good perspective, people like Bill Gates and others, they have a lot of that entrepreneurship in them, and that's why they are able to amass money. And like they're visionaries who really like the hippies of the 60s and people like that who had visions about things and saw into the future and were willing to fight for these ideals and things like that. They don't care about money that much. They're not interested in spending time starting up a coffee place or starting a new business because their interest in life lies elsewhere. So naturally, the visionary who's going to be investing his life in causes and things like that and visions and dreams is not going to have as much money as the conqueror. But it's not... There's nothing unfair or unjust about it. It's just that he has a personality that makes him a moneymaker, while the other person is more fulfilled and happy doing other things that don't have to do with money necessarily. So I hope that this is all kind of explaining why it's very, very important to make sure that we in the Constitution have something that defends and protects wealth, that we have the need for rich people who, in a fair system, without, the elements of oppression, the bastard from Amazon who is an exploiter of people. If you take away the exploitative element, we just have people being capitalists and doing things and working hard and playing fair by the rules and not doing anything dirty, that we're going to have. We need these people, and we need people who accumulate wealth so that we can have economies of scale. And when these people arise, we have to constitutionally declare that to not be treated as a sign of unfairness. It's just different people doing different things, and because we're all so different, we'll have different outcomes, even if there is no or different flavors of outcome, even if there is no injustice forcing that inequality. So and that should be inherent in the Constitution, and so we need a system that protects capitalism. And make sure that no one in the House of Commons will be tempted to write bills that force people to, quote, share the wealth, because that's the communist or, shall we say, the right, quote, thing to do, because the Constitution will say, no, we are going to promote capitalism in the society. And so if we can protect capitalism at the constitutional level, then we can worry a little bit less, and instead of worrying about, you know, taking down specific people who are promoting Maoism and communism, we have the Constitution protecting capitalism in an overt way, we'll be better off. And as I've always clarified in the past, capitalism is not Wall Street. Wall Street is not capitalism. Wall Street is a completely abhorrent or an aberration of capitalism, and capitalism doesn't mean that we are not going to have compassion. The Constitution will also have elements of compassion in it, but not the way the socialists want to have compassion. So that's more or less what we wanted to talk about in this snippet. And just as a quick thought, it's also important to emphasize the fact that in the Constitution, we are not going to allow property taxes any longer. And I know that that's one of the greatest sources of income in many American states. Many American states and cities live off of property taxes, but that is fundamentally flawed, because it violates one of those generic principles we were talking about that will be in the Constitution that says that taxation should be economically neutral. In other words, other than just the natural effect of taking money away from people and giving them less to spend on, which is so no tax is neutral, completely neutral. It takes money from us, and we're left in a different state than we were before our taxes were taken away. So it's impossible to have complete neutrality, but economic neutral aside from that. So in other words, it should not affect our economic decisions. We shouldn't change the way we produce a product just to get around a taxation hurdle. And probably making the product more inefficiently, because the inefficiency is less than the tax we have to pay, the extra tax we have to pay for that inefficiency, if we didn't go the inefficient way. So it has to be neutral, economically neutral, and the property tax is not economically neutral because it punishes people. If you have a whole bunch of money in the bank, okay, that's already been taxed, it's there, it's yours. If you take that money and you invest it in a house, the moment you put it into a house and it becomes equity, your personal equity, then the government starts punishing you every year with a certain percentage. You're going to start paying thousands of dollars every year just for owning the house, even if you're not using the house, even if you're not renting it, even if it's just lying there, just for the sake of existing, the government, state government or whatever, is coming in and taking money away from you. So the money you put into the house starts getting slowly ripped out from you. So in other words, you're not going to invest in a house so you have to start thinking, okay, can I cover the property tax? And if I have the money in the bank, there's no tax on that. But if I put it in a house, it's the same money, but just because I changed its shape, and it took the shape of a house, then I'm going to start getting punished. So that means that if I have to build the house, let's say that the house is, it's not you buying a house, it's you buying a land and building the house, you're going to have to think twice about it. And if you decide not to do it because of the tax, then all the people who would have been employed by you investing in building the house would be left unemployed. So that tax is not economically neutral. It changes the way you think. And it's a tax that punishes, that violates another constitutional principle that needs to be added in the new constitution that says, and I call it the inertia clause, that no taxation should tax things just on account of their existence. So a tax should not be applied on a house just because the house is sitting there. If the city wants to collect money, let it do it through the income tax mechanism. Let them have an income tax and so be it. But don't tax a house just because it's sitting there, and that violates the principle of inertia. In other words, you cannot tax something just because it's there, and that includes us as people. And that's why Obamacare and its so-called mandate, here in America, that forces people to buy health insurance, and if you don't buy it, you're going to get penalized, and it's called a tax. That is morally wrong, metaphysically wrong, and it should be unconstitutional, because it is taxing, it is punishing you just for existing. It's not that I went and did something, and I'm being taxed. For what I did. It's just me standing around as an American citizen, just standing around for a year, and just for doing that, I'm punished with a penalty of thousands of dollars if I don't go out and buy health insurance, even if I didn't do anything, even if I don't get sick, even if I don't go to a doctor, even if I'm the healthiest person on the face of the earth and never use the emergency room in a hospital, even if I'm no cost, medical cost to anyone, I'm being punished just for existing. That is morally wrong, and it is a violation of your right to life and your right to property, because it's saying we're going to punish you for existing, and we're going to take away money that you have earned. So it's a violation of those two things, and that's what happens with the property tax as well, even though in this case it's related to a thing, not to the person per se. So that's one thing that I wanted to share in this snippet as well. And these things need to be put into the Constitution. And just as a side note, when it comes to penalties, just like the Obamacare penalty here in America, where if you don't buy health insurance, you get punished. Then with a tax, we have to be careful in the Constitution to make sure that no one gets around the taxation limitations of the Constitution by calling them penalties. And I'm not too clear on how that could be done. But I know that eventually when the new constitution is written, someone will come up with a way, or maybe I will understand it better as well. But I know that somehow we will find a way to put that clearly into the constitution so that no one can say, oh, we're gonna raise money. And because the constitution says that we can only do certain types of taxes, we're not gonna call it a tax, we're gonna call it a penalty. So now we're gonna penalize people, for example, for having a house, so it's a penalty. And if you don't use the house, then you're going to get penalized. So you own it, but you're not doing anything with it. We're going to punish you for that. That is a tax, and that should be in the Constitution. I think it basically boils down to the idea that if something is revenue for the government, and it's not the result, it's not a penalty related to criminal activity or a violation of the law, then it has to be treated as a tax, and it falls under the limitations of the Constitution. But even that seems a little bit vague, because if I come up with a law that makes it illegal for me to not have health insurance, then again, we fall into the same pit. So we have to have a way in the Constitution to make sure that at no point the government raises revenue by taxing people just for existing, or by taxing property or equity just for being there, and also that it doesn't use the penalty excuse as a way to introduce some sort of sales tax or an excise tax or any other form of taxation. So these are the thoughts that we wanted to share in this snippet, and we'll continue talking about economic issues and maybe continue with our talk on the legislative process in the House of Commons under the new Constitution. But we'll see. I hope this snippet was of some interest and some help. Thank you.